Hi, I'm Kevin Flynn, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about episodes 1 and 2 of the team's latest series on Wayne Brady and Carl Willis, two men arrested over 22 years ago for the murder of Maurice Purify in Toledo, Ohio. If you haven't listened to those episodes yet, this conversation may not make a whole lot of sense, so make sure you go back and do that before listening. Our guest today, Amber Hunt. Amber is the host of the Accused podcast from the Cincinnati Inquirer and Crimes of the Centuries, a podcast on the Obsessed Network, and one of my favorite people in podcasting. Hello, Amber.
Hi. Thank you.
And Colin Miller. Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law and one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast and the reason we're all here. Hi, Colin.
Hey, Kevin. How are you doing?
Good. Let's just start with a quick summary of episodes 1 and 2. In episode 1, the Undisclosed team discussed how a grand jury initially refused to indict Carl Willis and Wayne Brady despite Travis Slaughter's claim that the three of them murdered Maurice Purify. Then, a second grand jury indicted Willis and Brady after Chandra Rayford corroborated Slaughter's claim, and Willis and Brady were eventually convicted of the murder despite Rayford's refusing to answer questions at trial. In episode 2, the Undisclosed team took you into the interrogation room for some of the 6.5-hour interrogation of Travis Slaughter by Toledo police officers who might have coerced a false confession. Colin, I want to start with you because we're just kicking off this season, and I want to ask you, when you are picking a potential case to cover for a season of Undisclosed, what elements are you looking for? I mean, there's a story in every criminal appeal, right? Do you come at it as a lawyer who weighs the appeal of the case or like a journalist/podcaster would, a case that itself tells an interesting story?
Yeah, so on the first aspect of that, it was interesting. When we did the Dennis Perry case, who, of course, has now been exonerated based upon DNA evidence, Clara Gilbert, the head of the GIP, told Susan, Colin's not going to want to take this case because he waived his right to appeal and he's going to know he can't appeal and so he's not going to want to take the case. And that's not a factor for me. I don't care whether they're out of appellate options or not. I actually approach it, Kevin, not from a lawyer's perspective, but a law professor. I like to take cases that have interesting legal concepts that I can explore. And so in this case, the grand jury and the non-indictment in the first grand jury proceeding was the interesting angle I wanted to explore in this season.
Amber, your podcast, Accused, just came out with season 4. And if you're on Patreon, like I am, support you on Patreon, you get the whole season. So I would suggest that you do that if you're impatient like I am. But it covers the case of Elwood Jones, who's currently on death row. So what can you tell us about this season?
So the season focuses on a man named Elwood Jones, nicknamed Butch, who was convicted of killing a 67-year-old grandmother named Rhoda Nathan in her hotel room in Blue Ash, Ohio, back in 1994. And he's on death row. So it's an important case. What's been interesting, especially listening to the past two seasons of Undisclosed, is how no duh, like it's so frustrating. You're screaming at it because you're like, what are you talking about? Why are we even discussing this? But this case for season 4, it's not like that. It really required us to listen to the accused and say, okay, he's claiming this, but is it true? And then dig in. So it's quite a bit. It was quite a challenge. It's always interesting too. I knew this case because of Forensic Files. And you know, I remember watching that show with my mom. There's actually, I didn't put it in the show, but there's this moment where I was talking to the defense lawyer and she's like, and then the Forensic Files. And I was like, you watch your mouth. But you know, it turns out that when you try and boil something down into 30 minutes, it's not always accurate. So.
Yeah, you want to be able to stretch your legs with the story like you can in a podcast.
Right. Yeah, thank God for this, by the way. Thank goodness that we have this storytelling medium now, because we're able to take deep looks at really complicated cases. And same as Colin, I'm always looking for issues that weren't prevalent in previous cases. I always want to try and teach about the system through each season.
Colin, I don't know if you're like me, but I happen to have in my hands here my copy of the book Accused by Amber Hunt and Amanda Rossman, The Unsolved Murder of Elizabeth Andes. It's the complete transcript from the popular podcast. So if you don't have time to listen to something and you'd rather just read, you can get this. I don't know, Amber, if it was one of my listeners or one of yours, but they wanted to know if this was going to come out in an audiobook. I said, well, it's a podcast, so even better, it's free.
Exactly.
Colin, have you been listening to Amber's new season of Accused, and what's your take so far?
Yeah, so I'm definitely a huge fan of Accused. I've been listening since day one, and for this case, Amber reached out to me, I think maybe last fall or last summer, asking about, there was bacteria found on Elwood or Butch's hands, and that was some of the evidence used to convict him. And so that led me down the rabbit hole of looking at this bacteria. But, you know, from what she sent me and looking at the appellate documents and hearing, I think it's episode 3 is the most recent one, because I don't have Patreon. But Jimmy Johnson, I think, is his name, Amber, if that's right, who, it's interesting. I saw the parallel between that case and this case. He testifies, I saw Butch's bag the day after the murder, and it didn't have this pendant or this locket from the victim, which, of course, the police then later say, we found this, and this is the smoking gun that connects him to the crime. And then when Jimmy testifies at trial, the prosecutor essentially tries to impugn his credibility by implying he has this extensive criminal record. And Amber goes in the episode into how he really seemingly didn't have that record. But how do you unring that bell and have the jury ignore what they heard the prosecutor asking about at trial? And so I think that Jimmy Johnson testimony was pretty huge for me in thinking, wow, this really could be a wrongful conviction.
Unringing a bell is something that runs through both of these podcasts. Colin, you start with that famous ham sandwich quote. A lot of us have heard it was made by Judge Saul Watchdier. I think I'm saying that right.
Watchdier, I think.
Said it in 1985. It was funny, but was it illuminating?
I think so. I first heard about it, I think, in The Bonfire of the Vanities, I think Tom Wolfe cites to it. And I think it's illuminating because, you know, A, you hear the statistics that we had in the episode about how rarely grand juries refuse to indict, and it's the way we have the system set up. But I think it's also illuminating because you think about it, you know, like a ham sandwich, it's an inanimate object, right? It can't defend itself in the grand jury, which is the position the defendant's in. They're not there in the grand jury room. They can't present evidence. They can't cross-examine. And so it's illuminating both. It shows the ease with which you can do it, but also the lack of defense that a ham sandwich or a person would have before the grand jury.
Yeah, the Constitution doesn't really protect lunch meat, so I think it would be easy to kind of push it around. Amber, I don't know if you know this. Well, you wouldn't know this, but my mom served on a federal grand jury. I think it was one Thursday a month for like 18 months, something like that. You know, a real commitment makes you wonder about, you know, if the kind of people who have the ability to do that kind of service, if they're representative of the population as a whole. She said, you know, federal cases, so it's, you know, it's a lot of racketeering and drug indictments. They indicted every case except one.
Wow.
They billed one of them. The prosecutor came in and sat down with the grand jury and asked them why. You know, kind of, well, what were we missing? What was, you know. So, I mean, close to batting 1,000. It is supposed to be, I guess, a low bar, but it still shouldn't be a rubber stamp, right?
Absolutely. I think what's amazing is how many people think that the charges mean solid evidence. The mm-hmm. fact that somebody is charged, well, they wouldn't charge them unless there was something really there. No, actually, that's not how the system is set up. It's an incredibly low bar. And then in this new season, Colin, there's the witness who doesn't want to testify, and then they strike it from the record. And that kind of stuff is so infuriating because it's supposed to be beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not supposed to be, well, I read between the lines. And so I think, you know, I'm going to go ahead and convict this person.
By the way, Judge Wattler, he believes he was misquoted. He believes that he had said this was, he said this not in a legal brief, but to the New York Post. And he believed, because he's Jewish, he would never have said ham sandwich. He believed he said pastrami sandwich. Again, one of history's great misquotes, if it were true. The funny thing is that he himself later was indicted. And he's not a ham sandwich, but he did get it from both sides of the legal system.
Yeah, well, coming from a Jewish family from New York who went to many New York City delicatessens growing up, I think that's probably right. He probably was misquoted. They would say pastrami and not ham, I would imagine.
Yeah, and those pastrami sandwiches are the real, they're thick.
Yeah.
When you get one, you want to bring over four other people to help you finish it. Yeah. All right, let's get serious, though, about this case here. Colin, tell us about Maurice Purify. He was only 13 years old. What was the original working theory of the murder?
So very originally, when they very first found the body in the middle of the road, they thought this is a hit and run. Someone was driving, struck him, left him in the road, and then drove away. Then very quickly, when they flip him over, they see the bullet holes, and they say, okay, this is obviously a murder. And then really, it's the very next day they get the Crime Stoppers call saying Aaron Pettis murdered Maurice Purify. And again, as we laid out, there's some pretty solid evidence that he had burglarized the home belonging to Terry Lake, Aaron Pettis' friends. That Aaron Pettis and Terry Lake were together at a festival around that same time. And that therefore, as retaliation for that, they murdered Maurice Purify. And then Aaron Pettis passes a polygraph. That goes away. And then eventually, Travis Slaughter emerges as a suspect.
So, as you noted in episode one, Colin, you mentioned that the first grand jury did not indict. Do we know exactly what happened in that grand jury proceeding? I guess it's supposed to be secret. So, do we have a clue?
We don't. And as you said, it is secret. When you have the actual trial and the grand jury indicted, many jurisdictions have the Jenks Act, which says you get disclosure of what the witnesses said before the grand jury. But when the grand jury doesn't indict, you don't get any of that. So we don't know if it's the same grand jury, a different grand jury. What we do know is unless there is incriminatory evidence that was not presented at trial, all they could have presented at the first grand jury is what Travis Slaughter said during that interrogation we played in episode two, and some forensic evidence, none of which connects Wayne or Carl to the crime.
And we don't even know if they were the same.
Yeah.
And panel grand juries. They could have been two separate. Yeah.
Yeah. As you say, grand juries can serve for 12 months, 18 months, 2 years. This was 8 months later, I think, between the two grand juries. But we don't know the composition of the two different grand juries, whether they were different or the same.
Yeah. You know, Amber, I see the parallel with last season of Undisclosed, in which the jurors don't believe the defendants committed the murder, but they do believe the guy who accused them of being involved in the murder and the crime. In that case, it wasn't a grand jury last year. It was a trial jury. But it just seems to, you know, sort of defy logic that if they're not the killers, how could this snitch be involved in what is legally not a killing? I don't know. Help me out.
I mean, so along the same lines, people think the prosecutor wouldn't be going after this person if she did not believe wholeheartedly, you know, and probably there's stuff that we're not allowed to see yet and blah, blah, blah. Well, there is actually, there's probably some thought processes going on too, where, you know, if I believe that this person did it, my brain is going to make the assumption that this person wants to get out of full responsibility. So I might go down the path of, okay, is he just trying to spread blame around so that, you know, other people go down for him or at least with him. So, I mean, it makes sense to me that people would be skeptical of that kind of testimony. At the same time, though, it's like, it is so surprising that they didn't indict the first time around. I would love to just sit down and talk to somebody at some point and be like, when do you give up as a prosecutor? Like, when do you say, you know what, I might have been going down the wrong path here?
Yeah, I guess if in your mind you're like, these three defendants did it, I'm going to get one of them at least, right? I got out, even if, you know, two are more culpable than the, you know, the third. Somebody's got to swing for this.
Yeah. And
I think it's kind of a natural, I don't know, competitive juices, or this is, you know, this is my oath and I owe it to the family. I think a lot of emotion gets involved sometimes when you can't, you know, when logically it would be you should walk away from this. If we're a used car salesman, if the stakes were something like that, you'd walk away. It seems like because the stakes are so high, you'll do things that may not seem like they made sense in hindsight.
I almost give that a pass. The part that really bothers me is that I think so much of it is just rooted in ego.
Yeah.
I believe that this happened, therefore it must have happened, and I have to stick my landing here and keep going. No, you could be wrong. Why are we not more comfortable in this world saying, yeah, sometimes I'm an idiot and I could have been an idiot here. You know, if you have enough physical evidence to back up the one, then maybe just go down that path, because that is the way the system is supposed to work. It's not just supposed to be pointing fingers and then getting convictions based on the finger pointing.
Amber, just stick with you for a second. You're in season two of Accused. You cover the case of William Ricky Virgil, who was released based on DNA testing and not reindicted by a grand jury. So you wrote an article about his attorney in the civil wrongful conviction action, not getting records of what happened before that grand jury. What did you think of that ruling?
That is really fascinating to me. On the one hand, it is supposed to be secret, but on the other, if this lawyer has no idea why the jury this time around didn't pursue, and maybe whatever was shared with that jury actually points to some kind of liability on the part of the prosecutors or the police. I mean, I would be interested in knowing what Colin's thoughts are on the hard and fast rule that it's behind closed doors.
Yeah, I was going to ask you too. I mean, what's your take on that?
My take is, you know, the reason we have grand jury secrecy, it's to protect the witnesses and to protect the defendant, right? So obviously, when a defendant is now a civil plaintiff seeking damages for wrongful conviction, they need no protection anymore. They want those documents. And then unless there's something sensitive with the witness where you can really, as a prosecutor, point to something and say, look, we need to prevent this from seeing the light of day. Again, it's not being used to impugn the witness or to try to get someone to, I mean, that's the concern, right? Is the defendant, their co-conspirators will harass, will threaten, will intimidate this witness. But again, this person's been exonerated and they're seeking relief from the state. So unless there's a compelling reason for the prosecution to say we need to not have this be released, I think certainly in a civil wrongful conviction action, the defense should get access to that.
But somewhere in the world, there's a tape recording or a transcript, or that exists somewhere. It's just somebody has made the determination that you can't see it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's in the state's interest not to do that because it's a civil wrongful conviction action. And as we've seen with some undisclosed cases, that can lead to settlements or judgments upwards of $8, $9 million.
Yeah, you know, if a cop gets arrested, you know, usually his colleagues aren't allowed to do the investigation, or certainly if a prosecutor, you know, there would be a conflict. Boy, it just doesn't seem like one state ever asks another state to help them out with that. They just seem to be, well, this could be on us, so we're going a different direction. It's hard to get relief like that. Amber, we heard that after Chandrea Rayford stopped testifying at trial, the judge instructed the jury to just disregard her testimony. This was halfway through. This wasn't like the whole testimony. Just heard one side and then ignore it. But we heard from the jury foreman that the jury did the exact opposite. Here we go, another unrung bell. Human nature here, it seems like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
That was a great comparison.
Yeah, we got the ham sandwich. We got the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. It's hard to, you know, not think of an elephant if I tell you don't think of an elephant.
Yeah, I have that problem. I actually As soon as I decide I need to focus on something else, I'm completely focused on the thing I'm trying to forget about. I thought that was really interesting. So in the situation with the Elwood Jones case, Jimmy Johnson, it was the last question. It was kind of a throwaway. It was a cheap shot, frankly, because they were basically just trying to get in front of the jury, like, hey, you can't trust this guy. He's a criminal. And oh, withdrawn, you know. But then this one, as bad as that one was, I can understand why a judge wouldn't be so keen to say, okay, mistrial, right? Because there was all this testimony leading up to it. You've got all these people involved that, you know, other witnesses have testified at this point. It's a big to-do to call a mistrial. But in this case, I mean, this was not just some quick aside. The very existence of this witness was huge to the case. So once she's no longer comfortable testifying, you can't just go, hey, forget about that. You know, it's not something people can do.
Well, I guess, Colin, the law does say if not a mistrial, the judge could give a curative instruction, which is, yeah, forget that. But I have to, again, think it was just there was no cross-examination of the witness. So they just heard the accusation and a lot of, I believe, pleading the fifth. Am I remembering that correctly? So it just seems like it would be, in practical sense, to just wipe away remembering half of the story. It just doesn't seem like an instruction would really cure, the damage done.
Yeah, this is interesting. Actually, the current scholarly article I'm working on now is this exact situation, which we haven't solved in centuries, which is something goes wrong at trial. We have these two options, right? The curative instruction for the reasons that Amber and you just mentioned in the episode, often ineffective, you can't unring the bell. A mistrial, you might think is great for the defendant, but empirical data shows the likelihood of a wrongful conviction increases on retrial. Defendant has lengthy pretrial incarceration extended by a mistrial. If they're paying for their legal defense, they're often limited resources are depleted. And so my proposal in the article is, like we have standby counsel for a pro se defendant, we should have standby judges. And that in a case like this case, the judge should be able to say, look, I could give a curative instruction here. I could declare a mistrial, or I acknowledge you can't unring this bell. Let's dismiss the jury. I, as the judge, if you want, is going to decide this case, which has its own issues because judges have their own biases, but I think in a case like this, the judge would do a better job resolving the case than the jury.
This was not one of those cases where the prosecution made a mistake or did a dirty trick. It just sort of it fell apart on the stand to everybody's dismay.
Correct, except, I mean, there were some tea leaves there the prosecutor could have read, and you might say might have manipulated Chandrea Rayford's testimony. So you could say, on the one hand, this is a surprise witness who all of a sudden went mum, but you could also say there's some complicity there by the prosecutor.
I like your third option. I think that makes a lot of sense, even though, again, judges are people too, and then he would have to try to, or she would have to try to ignore what, half of what the witness said. But, they're professional about it, and they've been thinking about these things and understand, why it's necessary to shut that out.
I have a quick question. Do you have any idea how often that matter plays into successful appeals? Either, there was a curative instruction when there was no way for the jury to forget. My guess is that most of the time you see, but substantially the allegations, it wouldn't have changed the outcome of the trial. Am I right?
Exactly. That's my research. I don't have a specific number, but the vast majority of cases I found, exactly as you say, is, oh, well, we trust jurors to honor a curative instruction, and there's enough evidence they could have convicted anyway. And so if it's error, it's harmless error, and we're not going to grant a new trial.
Yeah. Amber, you were talking about how in episode three of your season, we heard there was an improper implication that maybe the key witness for Elwood, Jimmy Johnson, had a nasty criminal record before the defense could object. Withdrawn, like we see on Law and Order all the time. Withdrawn, Mr. McCoy. Do you think the jurors, Colin, could ever disregard what they hear in the courtroom, particularly in this case that Amber looked into and accused?
Yeah, well, this is interesting because I guess my prior article is about defendants having a right to an implicit bias jury instruction. And so one of the studies that I cite to there, it involves an illegal wiretap that implicates the defendant, I think, in a drug crime. And so the interesting thing is, in that study, they found, well, A, the jurors didn't ignore the instruction, but B, when you change the race of the defendant, there's a statistically significant difference. So, you know, four scenarios. They don't hear the wiretap, white defendant, black defendant. They hear the wiretap, they're told to ignore it, white defendant, black defendant. And so sort of the modern theory of racism that implicit bias goes to, and this, of course, gets to critical race theory and all that, is that when there's wiggle room in a decision, that's where bias is most shown nowadays. And so they found the biggest difference when the jurors heard the wiretap and it was a black defendant, they convicted at much higher rates than a white defendant. So I think, A, you can't ignore it as a juror, and B, it has racial implications, which certainly plays into the Brady and Willis case.
Amber, in season one of Accused, you cover the murder of Elizabeth Andes, with her boyfriend, Bob Young, claiming he falsely confessed to her murder after 15 hours of interrogation. What was it like listening to the clips of the interrogation of Travis Slaughter?
Pretty infuriating.
You hear some of the same things, yeah?
Yeah, there were some of the same things. First off, the consistent denial. And, when you talk to people, they're like, of course he's going to deny. And I get that. Yes. Okay. But it's concerning to me when somebody keeps going at it from different angles without any additional insight or information. It's not as though he tripped up and he said one thing that they then started pulling a thread on. They just kept coming at it from different angles. Mm. So then there was also the thing with them bringing up his previous allegations. So he was already in
the legal. Arson,
the arson, the rape, which, you know, is not good.
Right.
But doesn't have anything to do with this case. And then the idea that, it's just innocently brought up. It's not, of course it's going to weigh on his mind. I'm already in trouble. I need to cooperate with these people. And, additionally, they have this tendency to reword things so that it's hypothetical. And then the hypothetical gets the suspect, the person being questioned, in trouble because they say, well, yeah, something like that could happen. And then that starts them down this path of, okay, so this is what happened. We understand that this kind of thing can happen. So tell us more about it. And, and then they get tired.
Yeah.
Because it's been 6.5 hours.
Or 15. Can you imagine being in an argument with your spouse for 15 hours? You would confess to anything.
Seriously, how many times have you stopped a marital or, partnership argument by going, you're right.
Yeah.
And the stakes are so low. You're right.
You mix the recyclables with the garbage. No, I didn't. After a couple hours, sure. Yeah, I did. I'm sorry. You put yourself at the scene of the garbage, Mr. Flynn. Keep going on that. I was struck in Travis's interrogation about the way they used his prayer against him. Anybody else kind of go, ugh?
Yeah, and that, I only played a portion of the interview, but there was a huge part of that. I think someone read some of the comments by the lieutenant, but there was a lengthy process talking about the demons inside of you and coming clean to Jesus and not doing this and dying with this lie in your soul. And so, they really played at the religion angle there once they were aware that he was religious and had heard this prayer that he made.
Was listening to 6.5 hours of interrogation fun, Colin?
No, it's not. It's never fun. But, this obviously has echoes of Making a Murderer, right? Where this is someone who clearly has a diminished capacity, has some form of intellectual disability. And it's clear.
He says that he's easily led. Right.
Right. Yeah. And they're talking about how he's been mistreated his whole life based upon that by his mother, by his former friends, etc., and how they're going to treat him right. And they can help him out if he can just tell them what happened. And you know, you can really help yourself out and you weren't really responsible. There's a reason for this. And so to play upon that over the course of 6.5 hours is quite disturbing to listen to.
So much that happens because of the reed technique and, you know, the poison fruit, I guess, that gets harvested from it. The 1960s saw a bunch of landmark cases for defendants' rights. Mapp, Gideon, Escobedo, Miranda, of course. Colin, what is the likelihood in 2022 that the courts might strike down things that, you know, the usage of the reed technique or, you know, similar ways of correcting this wrong in the justice system?
We just tried last year. So there's a Supreme Court case, Siebert, which is about a two-step interrogation process. You don't Mirandize the suspect. You get a confession. Then you Mirandize them. Then they confess again. Is that constitutional? And so this was a case involving an 18-year-old, like with Travis Slaughter. And we tried to get the Supreme Court to take this case and to clarify Siebert and kind of go against the Reed technique, looking at wrongful convictions based on false confessions of teenagers, etc. They didn't take the case. We're going to keep trying. And, you know, hopefully in the next few years, this Supreme Court, in terms of criminal procedure, is actually pretty decent. And so I think there's some hope that in the next 5 years, there could be a landmark ruling on this.
Amber, I wish I had Colin's optimism. I just feel like that the pendulum is swinging the other way when it comes to siding with law enforcement over defendants' constitutional rights.
It's a tricky time to predict what's happening right
now.
I will say, I'm familiar, obviously, with Reed technique. I wasn't aware until last season of Accused that the case upon which the technique was born was overturned. I didn't know that. So that I'm hoping with Robbie, I'd like to do a Crimes of the Centuries episode on it, because that's exactly the kind of thing where I had no idea. And I'm in this field, but there are all these little, that's fascinating. That's just fascinating.
Yeah. And Colin, remind me, on retrial, Miranda was convicted, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
That happens with a lot of these cases. So as I said, they've been favorable, but yeah, that's Orrin Kerr, who's probably the biggest criminal procedure Fourth Amendment scholar, always writes about how the classic is you win your Supreme Court case and then you get convicted on retrial.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, this Supreme Court, I got to say, when we look at the Curtis Flowers case, I was really surprised at who came out of the shadows to be one of the most vocal supporters of his case. I would say that I did not see that conservative voice sticking with Curtis Flowers' argument here. Can we go to the social media feeds and take a couple of questions? This is to Evidence Prof and Undisclosed. Here's a question, WTF. Boy, that's an evergreen one. I think just about every Undisclosed season is that. This is from Ellenis. She says, it was excruciating to listen to that, quote, interrogation. Shit show, broken heart emoji. I know it's no solace to Travis, but they would have went ahead anyway. There are plenty of examples of people not budging, but still getting convicted anyway. Reed technique has to go. Do you agree with that, Colin, that they would have gone ahead anyway?
In terms of gone ahead anyway, you know, if they didn't use the Reed technique, I don't think he's confessing. And without his confession, there's no way this case goes to trial, especially with what happened with Chandrea when she took the stand. So, no, I mean, I think in this case, really, it is the Reed technique that led to two, possibly three wrongful convictions here. Without that, he wouldn't have confessed to this crime.
This is from Jerkface Killa. I just love these handles. The big question is, why did the prosecution have such a hard-on for connecting Carl and Wayne to this case? I don't think I have to say that in nicer English. We all get what he means. Why was the prosecution really...
I'm not sure I follow, Kevin. Can you explain that?
If you don't know by now, I'm not telling you.
Sorry.
but let's break it down. Why was it Carl and Wayne that it had to be?
Well, I think you see it at the start of the interview. They ask him, who are your friends? I have no friends. I used to have two friends, Carl Willis and Wayne Braddy. Then he denies involvement in the crime. Then he sees a masked man committing the crime. They're not satisfied with that. And they say, look, you're walking down the street 4 a.m. Is it Carl that starts this? Is it Wayne? And eventually he adopts it. I don't think that they did have, so to speak, a hard-on for Carl and Wayne. It's just those are the only two friends that Travis mentioned. And Travis seems incapable of committing this crime by himself. So the obvious narrative to feed him is, you're the lookout where Carl and Wayne commit this crime. And he says, okay, yeah, sure. And eventually, you know, adopts that narrative.
Yeah. This is, I think, a really great question from LC666 Rock. What type of questioning is allowed at a grand jury? It feels like the prosecutor is leading the witness. No wonder she ultimately refused to continue with the testimony. I think this is, again, referring later on to Rayford. But are there professional guidelines or legal guardrails about what a prosecutor can tell a grand jury in order to get that indictment?
One limitation alone, they cannot knowingly suborn perjury. Okay. They have no duty to present exculpatory evidence. They can ask leading questions. They can ask about unconstitutionally obtained evidence. Grand jurors can ask questions, but bottom line is it's the prosecutor's show. They can basically do whatever they want before the grand jury.
And the data shows they're pretty successful when they get to have the first and last word. So Jill said, I struggle to follow this one because this is a really complicated case, as all the undisclosed cases are. Can you give us a little preview of what we're going to see in episode 3 that might start pulling some of these strings together?
So in episode 3, maybe somewhat unsurprisingly, we'll hear that Travis completely changes his story from his police interrogation when he testifies at trial.
Oh, where's my fainting couch?
And gives a completely new narrative of what happened. And so we'll hear both Travis's narrative at trial as well as the alibi defenses that the jury never heard at that trial.
Yeah. All right. Well, I am looking forward to coming back on Addendum and talking about future episodes. Do want to thank our guest, Amber Hunt. Amber, best of luck with Accused Season 4.
Thank you.
And Colin Miller, Associate Dean and Professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. Good luck on finishing this season. It sounds fascinating, and I can't wait to hear the rest of what you have.
Thanks, and let me quickly put a plug in. Joey Watkins from season 2 of Undisclosed finally has his habeas hearing in Georgia on February 28th. That will be live streamed. We don't have the information yet, but on social media, Twitter, Facebook, we'll share that feed. So on February 28th, you can tune in live to watch the arguments in the Joey Watkins case.
Well, season 2 seems like so long ago, doesn't it?
Yeah, 2016, I think. And now he's finally getting his day in court to decide his fate.
Yeah, good luck to him. So if you have questions about this case or any of the other cases covered on Undisclosed, you can ask them on social media. Just look for Undisclosed Pod on all the platforms. Production for The Addendum is by Hannah McCarthy. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime review podcast, Crime Writers On, and my Law & Order podcast, These Are Their Stories. Remember, the mothership returns to NBC next Thursday. I've got my popcorn. I hope you do too. Thanks so much to our executive producer, Mithil Telhan, and to Colin, Rabia, and Susan for continuing to let me be part of their work. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. More to come next week.